This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about how the Israeli policy against children has included arresting, detaining, interrogating, even torturing and imprisoning young children.
The Israelis have about 350 children currently in prison. This is against the international law because these children live in an occupied territory. The Israelis have occupied the West Bank since 1967 when their troops marched in.
We'll talk about President Obama's plan to eliminate nation-controlled nuclear power.
Bang! Never before have we been in more danger. We'll hear more from attorney Peter Weiss.
We'll discuss why human rights are indispensable to financial regulation.
And how fundamental aspects of human rights, the right to a job, the right to a home, the right to education, were violated by the bailout and other policies of the U.S. government.
Stay with us.
Heidi, Mumia's birthday is coming up.
Yes, Michael. April 24th is Mumia's birthday. He recently wrote a tribute to Paul Robeson on what would have been Paul Robeson's 110th birthday this past April 9th. The tribute is available on the World Web, and it's received tremendous feedback. He writes that for many years as a young man, he regarded Robeson as one of the greatest men that ever lived. Mumia cited an extraordinary life, a wealth of talents and abilities, a soaring intellect, but most of all, a magnificent heart, which in Mumia's words, quote, beat for all the oppressed of the world. I was struck at how Mumia's description of Robeson aptly describes Mumia himself. There is no limit to his talent and abilities, his intellect, and his equally boundless compassion for the political prisoners and for other oppressed persons and populations around the globe. Just one example of this. Mumia's most recent book is devoted to explaining the role, so important to society and so overlooked and even vilified, of jailhouse lawyers. The book is titled Jailhouse Lawyers Defending Prisoners v. the USA. And Mumia does in it an extraordinary job of humanizing all the men and women who work to uphold the Constitution against enormous institutional, societal, and legal obstacles. Always an educator in his work, Mumia describes how jailhouse lawyers were dealt a profound setback with the passage of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, the PLRA, of 1996 under the Clinton administration. In it, proponents argued that inmate litigation should be curtailed because of a tendency to bring frivolous lawsuits. Mumia, in his book, points out that highly publicized reports were actually totally untrue of inmates bringing suits over the kind of peanut butter they were given or the color of their towels. The lack of truth in these stories was reported in Prison Legal News in an article by Chief Judge John Newman of the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, outlining his reply to a letter printed in the New York Times and signed by the attorneys general of four states. Judge Newman showed how the attorneys general use lies and misrepresentation to support their arguments by contrasting the allegations against the actual facts in these cases. In a telling indictment against the PLRA, Mumia wrote that if the events of Abu Ghraib prison had occurred in an American penal institution, victims would not be eligible for damages under the PLRA, given that the law does not allow recovery for psychological or mental harm or injury. This book, and indeed all of the work that Mumia does behind bars, is evidence to his selfless character. In a judicial and penal system that has abrogated his rights, he responds nonetheless with quiet dignity to champion the rights of all the others who have also been denied their due justice.
Happy birthday, Mumia!
We talk today with Nora Barrows-Friedman, host of radio show Flashpoints at our Pacifica sister station, KPFA, in Berkeley, California. Nora spent the last month in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. She's been investigating stories about the ongoing violations of Palestinian human rights and has been frequently traveling there since 2004. Today, we look specifically at the Israeli policy against children, from arresting, detaining, interrogating, torturing, imprisoning, and even beating children, some as young as 10 years old. Nora says that international laws designed to protect children, including the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, are being circumvented and violated on a daily basis. Nora, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's really good to be here.
We've talked a lot on Law and Disorder about human rights violations in Palestine, but we haven't focused on those against children. Can you explain to us what you found out and how you recently were over there? What happened?
Yeah, well, I've been going back and forth to Palestine. This is my seventh year now, and I go several times a year, and I'm keeping up with people constantly every day when I'm not there. And one of the stories that I have been tracking and that has become more and more apparent over the years in terms of its regularity and the frequency and the amount of aggression that is just becoming more expanded is Israel's military tactics against Palestinian children.
What are some of the charges that these children are originally brought in on?
Usually the charges have to do with throwing stones at soldiers or tanks or any sort of apparatus of the invading military. Weren't doing anything. There were no witnesses. They said that they weren't throwing stones. They were just kind of randomly but deliberately picked off. The story that I kind of walked into, I was in the West Bank in Hebron talking to one of the field officers for an organization called Defense for Children International, and they have several offices around the West Bank. So I was talking to him, and he was telling me the story of this these two brothers, a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old, 12-year-old boys from that neighborhood, actually, that we were sitting in, who had been arrested by Israeli forces just a few days before. And we went to go visit the family. 5 minutes later, I was like, okay, well, let's go visit. And so we walked down, and what had happened was these two brothers were on their way to their relative's house on the other side of the old city. And as we know, Hebron is one of these places inside the West Bank where settlers have been given about half of the old city, and it's been closed off to Palestinians. This is a place where a settlement colony is inside a Palestinian community. Most of the settlements, are outside on the hillsides surrounding Palestinian villages, but rarely are they inside, except for, of course, East Jerusalem. There were, these settlers around. The military was very heavily, had a very heavy presence there. And these two boys were on their way to their relative's house. They were kind of followed by the soldiers. They were both grabbed. Both of them were separately handcuffed and thrown in the back of jeeps. They were both taken to a military detention center inside the nearby Israeli settlement colony of Kiryat Arba, where they were both separately detained, interrogated, blindfolded, handcuffed, forced to sit on a chair. The 12-year-old was then, after about 7 or 8 hours of interrogation, he was transferred to an adult prison facility near Ramallah, about an hour and a half away by car, where he remained for an entire week before being released. The 10-year-old child, meanwhile, was released at about 10 or 11 at night, so about 8 or 9 hours of interrogation. They had put a dog next to him, and as we know, in Arab culture, dogs are fearsome. They would provoke the dog into barking. They would threaten the child that he would never see his family again. They wouldn't let him go to the bathroom. He had wet himself. And finally, they called his father to come pick him up, late at night. And I saw the child and his mother and father, and I interviewed them about 3 or 4 days later while the 12-year-old brother was still in jail. About 6 or 7 hours after we left the house, after that interview, Israeli soldiers from the same unit broke into the family's home. It was about 2 in the morning. They broke into the family's home, dragged the 10-year-old child, Amir, from his bed. They held guns at the heads of the parents who were trying to, of course, protect their child. They said that, we'll kill you if you try to intervene. They snatched the child, took him downstairs, and beat him under the stairwell until he was unconscious and had internal bleeding. about 15 minutes later after the beating, the parents were able to retrieve him. They immediately rushed him to the emergency room, and of course, you know, he was in shock and total trauma. He wouldn't speak for about a day and a half afterwards, in complete shock. You know, the next week, I went back to visit the family, you know, after the kid was out of the hospital, and actually that was the day after the 12-year-old was released from prison. I mean, this whole family had been completely destroyed by this one week of just a completely random and very illegal incident against these two brothers.
Nora Barrows-Friedman, who's just back from reporting on the West Bank with this really horrific story. Is there any recourse that this family has? What laws are violated here? To whom might they report it?
From our culture, where we're like, okay, well, who do we sue? You know, how do we get the legal ball rolling? That's exactly what these parents were saying, except that in Palestine, the only recourse that Palestinian families have in this matter is to take it to the Israeli military court.
Is that because they're living under military occupation?
Yes, exactly. And Palestinian lawyers from the West Bank are not allowed to represent families from the West Bank.
Do they go to a military court?
I believe they are going to. They're, you know, they had to be in court a few times for the 12-year-old to get released from prison. You know, there are so many international laws violated here, and it was such a shocking story.
Did this receive any kind of notice in Israel?
It did, actually. It made the pages of Haaretz and a couple of kind of independent, you know, progressive left-wing outlets.
What could possibly be the rationale for doing what they did to these children?
Well, the soldiers told each of the children separately that they threw stones, and they would have to admit to throwing stones. And throwing stones sounds like a really nominal, you know, kind of ridiculous charge in itself, but the Israeli military has a military order, a law that it has made up, saying that throwing a stone at an Israeli soldier is similar to a federal offense, and it can land a child 10 years in prison.
And what's the minimal age where they can put a child in prison?
Well, according to the Geneva Conventions and the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child, 18 is the limit.
But what do the Israelis do?
The Israelis have 18 as the minimum age limit for Jewish Israeli children. But for Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, they've lowered that age standard to 16. Another law that they made up as some sort of juvenile delinquent law where they can arrest children as young as 12.
Do they imprison these people?
They do.
What's the numbers in terms of how many children of that age are in Israeli
prisons?
There's
approximately, and the numbers always fluctuate, of course. Sometimes children are in prison for a couple days, sometimes a couple months, sometimes a year or two. But right now, at this current moment, there are approximately 300 Palestinian children in Israeli prisons, you know, anywhere from, I believe, 12 to, you know, 18 years old, and then, of course, the adult population. And there's about 11,000 Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons overall.
This clearly sounds like an intentional tactic that not only is abusive physically and psychologically to the children, but also involves the whole family. I mean, it sounds like a form of torture to me.
It sounds to me like it's a form of torture and a way to try to get families to leave. Just
well, that's
to force
the exact tactic. And that's what many of the social workers that I talked to said, you know, because it's such a unbelievable and unbearable story. And this is not, you know, an anomaly. This happens regularly. I just happened to be there on the day that, during the week that the story was coming out. But yeah, especially in places like Hebron, where there is a really aggressive, very fundamentalist settler movement that are empowered by the current administration in Israel and have the backing and support of the local, you know, Israeli soldier battalion inside the city who protect them as they take over Palestinian homes and as they shoot Palestinians and as they throw garbage on Palestinians. These soldiers are there to protect the settlers. So the tactic really is to get these families so traumatized and so sick of the way that they're being treated that they eventually leave. The house that this family in particular lived in is really close to the settlement, and they're, you know, they're basically surrounded by these houses that settlers have their eye on. It seems to be very deliberate.
Nora, you've mentioned incidents with young boys. Have you seen any girls being arrested?
No, I haven't personally, but I know there are girls who have been arrested and beaten as well, on a lesser level, of course. But this does happen to girls and women. There are hundreds of women right now in Israeli prison for all sorts of charges as well. And you know, there's a famous story of a woman who actually gave birth while she was in prison, and the baby is now a prisoner. They have the baby listed and registered as a prisoner as well. So, you know, this is one of those stories that, you know, defies logic, that defies, consequently defies international law and all sorts of Geneva conventions.
If we might, can you tell us what your background is and how you got involved in going over to Palestine
sure.
for half a dozen years and
sure.
Reporting on it as you do? We read your material in the Electronic Intifada, Ali Abu Nima's excellent website.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved in all this? Where did you start from and how did you end up where you are now?
Well, obviously you can tell that I'm really passionate about this. I have been for a number of years, you know, even way before I started in radio. I'd grown up in a very anti-Zionist household. You know, I'm 100% Jewish, both sides of my family. You know, we come from Eastern Europe. But my mother was always very adamant about radical politics and how that figures into the responsibility that, you know, that Jews have to not perpetuate this kind of suffering anymore. And so, you know, actually my first best friend happened to be a Palestinian just by coincidence. And I've always grown up with kind of this narrative of, you know, injustice perpetuated in the name of world Jewry. You know, when I started working at KPFA in 2003 as an intern, I started the day of the shock and awe campaign against Iraq. And I had been listening for years to Flashpoints because of their coverage on the Middle East and Palestine in particular. And, you know, Dennis Bernstein, our wonderful host and my co-producer, he was so immersed in the Iraq story at that time that he wanted someone else to kind of take over Palestine. And so he just kind of handed me Palestine. Like, literally, he handed me a stack of papers and reports, and he was like, here, you do it now. So it was kind of baptism by fire. You know, I had started reporting on it about, you know, for about a year after that happened. But I really felt more and more like I couldn't do my job reporting on it if I hadn't been there myself and put my feet on the ground. And so in 2004, I started going, and I haven't stopped. And it's just, it's been so important to me to really be a vehicle to convey the reality on the ground that we're not hearing about in the mainstream media, not reading about in the newspapers, and really trying to understand the context of what's happening there as best as I can.
Nora Barrows Friedman, how do people reach you and your program, Flashpoints?
Well, we have a website, flashpoints.net. There's a lot of audio archives on there, a lot of links to other websites and blogs. There's a link to my blog on there, norabf, as in Barrows Friedman, .wordpress.com. And you can follow my reports there. I'm on Twitter, you know, Facebook, whatever. Flashpoints is really, you know, it's been the base of reporting for so many people, including Ali Abu Nima, who was there before I was there on Flashpoints. I also now write for Electronic Intifada, as you said, and Inner Press Service and Truth Out.
Well, Nora, it's been just a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to more updates in the future, hopefully with a positive development.
That's what we're all hoping for.
We'll link to your website, and I hope that you'll link with lawanddisorder.org to our website. Thank you so much, Nora Barrows Friedman, for being on Law and Disorder.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much.
Bye-bye.
Nine nations now have a combined total of more than 22,000 nuclear weapons. The United States alone has about 5,000 nuclear weapons, 500 of them land-based warheads, which can fly in 3 to 4 minutes after the order is given. The world is now even more dangerous than it was back in 1945, when the United States dropped bombs on both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, being the only country to ever do so. We talk about the current situation with respect to nuclear disarmament with Peter Weiss. Peter Weiss is an attorney and the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, as well as the vice president of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms. Attorney Peter Weiss, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be with you.
Peter, when I was first becoming aware of the nuclear threat, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists put out a magazine, and on the cover of the magazine there was a clock, and the clock was rapidly approaching midnight, and every time another awful thing would happen, the hands of that clock would advance. How close to midnight are we? What kind of progress, if any, are we making? What's the situation?
I would leave it where it is, because what's been happening recently is basically a reaffirming of the status quo rather than the progress that the president would like us to believe has been made. We've had three developments that have gotten a fair amount of press. First, there was the agreement with Russia on reducing the nuclear weapons allowed to each country from 2,200 to the small number of 1,550, which is a little ridiculous, you know, because whether you're killed by one of those 1,550 bombs or one of those 2,200 bombs doesn't really make a lot of difference. It just totally strains credulity to think that either country would ever have occasion to use 1,550 nuclear weapons or a much smaller number than that.
Peter, when you refer to weapons, are you talking specifically a warhead? Is that how they're counted?
Yeah, they're counted, but now they have this curious way of counting the warheads on a bomber, where they count all the warheads on a bomber as one instead of as 10 or 12. And by the way, when Jimmy Carter was in the White House, he told us recently at a conference that a single U.S. nuclear-armed submarine had enough warheads on board to eliminate, to destroy every Russian city of 100,000 or more, a single submarine.
Well, you said there was a triple threat. New START agreement that reduces the number of weapons that we have and that Russia has from 2,200 to 1,550. But also there was the nuclear posture review and then the recent nuclear security conference. Talk to us about the second one, the nuclear posture review.
Okay. Well, the nuclear posture review came out again with a trumpet salvo, big progress on toward zero, but in fact, I would call it basically a zero document. I had occasion a couple of months ago to ask one of the principal architects of the nuclear posture review at the Pentagon whether it was going to say anything about the president's vision of a nuclear weapons-free world, and his answer was, you know, it's difficult to operationalize a vision. You have to understand that this was taking place in Washington. That's the way they talk down there. And he was absolutely right. There's nothing in it about operationalizing the vision of a nuclear weapons-free world, except that the commitment, the mantra, the lip service that has been part of U.S. policy for the last 50 years. You know, they say, we like a nuclear weapons-free world, ultimately. And then if you read the fine print, you realize that it also says that as long as anybody has nuclear weapons, we have to have an adequate deterrent to protect ourselves and our allies. So that seems to me to cancel out the commitment to a nuclear weapons-free world, at least as long as anybody has any nuclear weapons.
Tell us about the third threat, the nuclear security conference.
Yeah, well, obviously there is a great danger of loose nukes, of nuclear material traveling around the world from country to country, and if and when Al-Qaeda gets a hold of enough of that to construct the weapon, and if they're able to do that, you know, I would prefer not to be in New York City. That's clear. But the way to deal with that, in addition to the security measures that they agreed on yesterday, which haven't really been spelled out yet, is to move aggressively toward what most of the world wants, which is a nuclear weapons convention, outlawing nuclear weapons in the same way that chemical and biological weapons have been outlawed by convention. And there's nothing in any of those three documents that we're talking about here that shows any willingness on the part of the United States, or for that matter, the other nuclear weapons powers, to go in that direction. But civil society will be urging the delegates at the forthcoming Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference at the UN, which starts on May 3rd and is going to run for about 3 weeks. And civil society will be given half a day to make statements to the delegates. We'll be doing that. We'll be saying, you know, do something about starting, taking the first steps. Actually, I was involved with some colleagues about 10 years ago in drafting a nuclear weapons convention, and it is now an official UN document. In October 2008, Ban Ki-moon formally endorsed the draft and said that's a good way to begin. You know, it's not being handed to anybody on a take-it-or-leave-it basis, but you can start negotiations looking toward the adoption of such a convention, and nobody seems ready to do that, except a lot of countries around the world that don't have nuclear weapons.
Peter, you're involved with the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms. What are they doing specifically?
They're going to be there at the conference in May that I just mentioned, and they will be speaking along the lines that I have outlined. I'm also president of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, which is the U.S. branch of the International Association. And we have a whole series of workshops planned. What your listeners may be interested in is there's going to be a big conference at Riverside Church May 1st, a Saturday, and then on May 2nd, there's going to be a big public demonstration in the streets, I think a march from Times Square to the UN. People can get more information about that by going to our website here, which is www.lcnp.org. United for Peace and Justice is also involved in that, and I think their website will have something.
In the 80s, I remember that sort of was my one of the issues I used to protest around, and there was a large anti-nuclear movement then that died. It seems from this that we might be having a resurgence of that people's movement, which I think is wonderful.
Oh, I think definitely. That's happening. I mean, that's the best thing about these official documents that we're talking about here, that it's going to re-energize the anti-nuke movement. And I don't want to be too hard on Obama about this, because I believe that when he called for a nuclear weapons-free world in Prague a year ago, I think he meant that. I don't think it was just talk. But then, as he said to the heads of state and other high officials of 47 countries day before yesterday in Washington, he said, words have to mean something. They can't be just words. And unfortunately, as far as official policy is concerned, they're just words. As far as civil society, anti-nuke movements are concerned, we have the plan
Peter, what did they actually conclude at the recent nuclear summit?
One of the curious things about it is that the main accomplishment is that it looks like the United States wants to be the sole repository of weapons-grade nuclear material, because what they got at the conference in the last 2 days, they got a commitment from Chile to ship their weapons-grade material to the United States. They got a commitment from Canada to do the same. And Mexico and the Ukraine have committed to either eliminate somehow, it's a big problem, their weapons-grade material, or ship it to the United States. So that's kind of weird, isn't it, that the U.S. would be the only repository of weapons-grade nuclear material.
Did these countries agree to that easily, readily?
Well, I don't know about readily, but they came, as somebody from the White House said, bringing gifts.
That's more of a Trojan horse than a gift. I don't know that I'd want that stuff in my backyard.
But how, right. You mentioned, how would they get, what happens, how are these destroyed of when they agree to get rid of them?
I don't think that problem has ever been solved. There was a conference held in Nevada, in Yucca Flats, which was supposed to be the place where they were going to bury it. The purpose of the conference was to decide what kind of warning signs to put up over that buried radioactive material so that the signs would still be legible 10,000 years from now. Hmm. I can't give you the answer to that. I know people are working on all kinds of technological ways to freeze it, to glassify it. But the problem has not been solved.
And if there were a natural disaster, such as an earthquake, which we've been seeing more of,
yeah,
would seem that could be quite a disaster.
It would multiply the disaster, right.
Peter Weiss, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
You're very welcome.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
This is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
Today we speak with Radhika Balakrishnan. Radhika is the head of the Center for Women's Global Leadership and holds a PhD in economics. Radhika recently wrote an article in Huffington Post titled, Why Human Rights Are Indispensable to Financial Regulation. In her article, she cites the World Bank estimates that an additional 400,000 children will die before their fifth birthday, while those responsible for the economic crisis and turmoil are benefiting from bailouts and promotion. She references the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights that give people the right to work, to education, to rest, and to an adequate standard of living. She also outlines steps for meaningful reform that may be able to make a difference in this economic crisis that is killing millions. She is currently working on a project trying to use human rights norms to evaluate and construct macroeconomic policy.
Welcome, Radhika, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, we're really happy to talk to you about, among other things, your recent article titled Why Human Rights Are Indispensable to Financial Regulation. And the first thing that we'd like to sort of look at is how financial regulation is accountable to human rights obligations.
Well, the point that we were trying to make in the article that James Hines and I wrote is really that, you know, when we talk about financial regulation and the regulatory framework in on the whole, we pretend as though that there are no criterion by which we can judge what regulation should be. And what we're arguing in our piece is that human rights actually has a way in which it can inform and give us an ethical basis to set up a regulatory framework. And when most people hear about human rights, they really think about civil and political rights, which is, you know, the right to speech, to not be wiretapped. I mean, all of those that are being violated, obviously. But most people don't understand that human rights also encompasses economic and social rights. And economic and social rights says that the state has an obligation to protect, respect, and fulfill economic and social rights.
Let me hold you there for one second,
sure.
On that, because I think that's a critical distinction, and it's one that we in the United States, of course, the government, takes a particular position about.
Yes.
The position is that if you get the right to vote, if you get political rights, that we don't have to worry about protecting economic and social rights, because the right to vote, the right to speak freely, basically the economic rights will come as a result of that, and therefore we don't have to protect economic rights.
Exactly.
You know, Europe and some other countries are much more even-handed about that. That's at least one point I'd like to hear you address, because it's a special problem in the United States.
It's definitely a special problem, and there are many countries, as you said, Michael, that, you know, have taken on the indivisibility of civil and political rights and economic and social rights. And for example, I mean, you bring up the idea of the right to vote. But if you can't read and you don't have the right to education, then you really aren't being able to use your right to vote, right? So the economic and social and the civil and political are indivisible. You can't have one without the other. And in the United States, as you said, the assumption is that just because you can vote the people in who can then give you economic and social rights, which are, it's a separate obligation of the state, is to make sure and ensure that people that live within the boundaries of that state are taken care of on economic and social ways. And the United States is one of the few countries that has no economic and social rights that are in our Constitution, for example. And it's something that I think that people really need to wake up to and address as we go through this crisis. You know, this crisis is really bringing up issues of vulnerability of the people who live here, and everyone's sort of grappling around, and it seems that the biggest issue that everyone is talking about is to reduce our deficit, which is so not the problem. The problem is that people are homeless, people are hungry. And the other thing is that this crisis did not fall in from the sky. I mean, the idea that this market is sort of some Greek oracle who speaks that we can't question is a problem. I mean, this crisis was manufactured. It was manufactured because of a re-regulatory process that allowed these kind of derivatives to take place and all these financial instruments. And there was no watchdog on how those regulations happened. And what we're saying is that it is a form of biased regulation. It's not sort of regulation and deregulation, where deregulation is without the state. We're saying that it's biased regulation, where the state has the interest of the financiers and the banks, and not those of working people and the working class, which is where they should. And one example of that is, you know, the minimum wage. The minimum wage has been stagnant for so long. That's definitely biased regulation.
How much is the minimum wage right now?
I think in New York it's $7.25 an hour.
Right, and you say that's biased. Why is that biased?
Well, let's put it this way. In 1980, the minimum wage was about $3.50, which was low. In order to buy the same basket of goods that you could with $3.50 an hour in 1980, you need $10, $12 an hour now. So what we've done is basically reduce the real wage of anyone who's making minimum wage.
So how does human rights help us look at that? We all know that's an outrage, but why do you think there's some legal obligation, or where does that stem, or what does human rights do for us in that?
Well, one of the things it does is it says that we have the state has an obligation to fulfill people's right to work, which means that the state has to do something. And for example, the Federal Reserve, right, has a dual mandate. One is to have price stability, but the second part of the mandate is the right to work. They keep trying to put policies that keep inflation low, but they're also supposed to put policies in that encourage and increase employment in the country. The other human rights standard that's important in terms of the minimum wage is that the state is supposed to have an adequate standard of living. An adequate standard of living is not a decreasing real wage over time for people making minimum wage.
Where is that written, and how can one enforce that? Isn't it? Are you just saying it's a moral claim, or is that an actual legal claim in America or in a higher body?
Well, in the United States, we have not signed the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights, which is something I think that people all around the country should advocate for and try and get this country to sign it.
Covenant is another word for treaty, and of course we did sign the Covenant on Political Rights.
Yeah, civil and political
civil
rights.
And political.
We've actually only signed two, that one and the third, which is the elimination of racial discrimination.
Right. We haven't signed this sort of laissez-faire country. We haven't sort of laissez-faire. This is the laissez-faire par excellence.
Capital of the globe.
Right. We obviously don't want to sign, the government doesn't want to sign economic and social rights because they don't want the idea that everybody should get the right to education, a right to shelter, et cetera, in our treaty.
Exactly. But we need to, as people living here, make them sign it.
Radhika, you mentioned that the Political Economic Research Institute has outlined some steps for reform. Regulations must be transparent and have an increase in accountability of financial and regulatory institutions.
The Political Economic Research Institute, James Hines, is someone that I work with on this project. And what we've done in the op-ed is we use the work of Jerry Epstein and others who are setting up an entire list of demands that come on the financial crisis and financial regulations. And so in our op-ed, what we did was sort of borrow from some of them.
We're speaking with Radhika Balakrishnan, who wrote along with James Hines a very good article posted in Huffington Post on March 29th entitled Why Human Rights Are Indispensable to Financial Regulation.
So what I would do is just also say that the approach that we're using is to try and look at the human rights angle on it. But what we're using in terms of the work we're doing just on the financial crisis as well as the other issues is to use the work of progressive economists around the country and around the world to base our human rights critique on solid evidence and solid research that's being done by left economists. And so this one is one of those attempts to do that work.
Radhika, one of the statements you made, which I wholeheartedly applauded, you talked about the Federal Reserve System being essentially a secret system.
Yes.
And that all our money went on these bailouts, and there's no transparency here. I was thinking that, one of the great demands that the movement could raise, which really encroaches on these people's prerogatives, is open the books. There should be transparency here. We don't know what they're doing with the money that they took from us to do it with.
Absolutely. The Federal Reserve is a government agency that should be transparent and that we, the public, should be able to see what their discussions are. And the fact that they're done in this cloak of secrecy is a real problem. I think there's a great case to be brought in terms of freedom of information.
As to what the Federal Reserve does, is
that it? What the Federal Reserve does, and let the public know what the discussions are, how they make their decisions, what kind of financial models they use to make their decisions. This cloak of secrecy because you want independence of monetary policy, but independence doesn't mean secret. Independence means it can be independent from the political will of the president and others, but the fact that the public doesn't know, and even the structure of the Federal Reserve is through the banking system. Their board of governors are from the commercial bank. So in whose interest are they going to work for?
No, I think that would be actually very important to get that information out. I want to go back to a question you asked about the Federal Reserve or a point you made about it, which is that it's supposed to both regulate inflation as well as give us full employment.
Yeah.
Now, I don't remember this, and I don't know if you will. Back 10 or 20 years ago when we had a high unemployment rate, there was congressional legislation, and maybe this is what you're referring to, that at least in its opening clauses said part of what this legislation is to do is to ensure that there's full employment in the United States. And we were always thinking of going to court and enforcing that. You're saying that's part of the Federal Reserve's mandate as well.
It is. It is. They have a dual mandate. Their mandate is employment and price stability, and it's both.
If there was full employment, wages would shoot up, because I think that the people that own and run things in this country, which is not us, like a huge pool of unemployment because it suppresses wages and therefore increases profits. And so I think the way the system works is on unemployment. It needs unemployment.
Well, if you're sort of using the argument of the reserve army of the labor force.
That's what I'm using, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's what capitalism is all about.
That's right.
But I think the idea that the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to reach full employment. It just means that their policies need to be evaluated in terms of whether they're moving towards employment-creating policies, price stability. And, you know, the U.S., this particular recession, the stimulus packages, some of the interest rate reduction of the Federal Reserve is more in line with employment creation. But I think taking this outside of the U.S. and making it global in terms of neoliberal economic policy is that many countries, because of the IMF's policy, cannot have a dual mandate. And many countries have to have only inflation targeting. And so because of that, Mexico, for example, where we've done research, has imposed inflation targets. So when they're going through a crisis, as they are now, their central bank does not have the flexibility to do the kind of policies that our Federal Reserve does. Whether they do it or not, they don't even have the right to do it. So I think it's not just in the U.S., but it's a global issue.
Right. So you're saying really two things. One is that when the IMF, International Monetary Fund, et cetera, goes outside the United States to other countries and their central banks, there's only one aspect to what those central banks in places like Mexico or Greece or whatever else can do, and that is deal with the inflation issue, and they can't deal at all with it. With
exactly.
The fact that people will be thrown out of work,
yep,
by countering inflation.
Yeah.
You're saying in the United States, at least the mandate indicates that they can deal with both, should deal with both inflation, deflation, as well as employment.
Exactly.
But unfortunately, in the United States, the latest, and maybe you should address that, the latest stimulus bill or whatever it's called seemed to have been fairly one-sided on those issues. Am I right about that? I always get mixed up between the TARP and the stimulus bill,
well,
or the bailout bill or
the
whatever.
Bailout.
Which is the bailout? TARP?
The bailout is the TARP that went to these financial agencies to give them the money to start lending again so that the financial sector would become whole. That money given to them is still sitting in the bank reserves. I mean, it hasn't gone out. And that money came overnight. It actually happened during the Bush administration and then renewed during the Obama administration. That money was a huge amount, I forget, $720-some billion, and given to the financial sector without a blink. The stimulus money, which is more employment creation, although a lot of it was tax cuts, which is not necessarily employment creation, is money that's going into roads and whatever the other stimulus projects are, was smaller, and a huge amount of fight, and now the public, and especially the sort of Tea Party people, but it seems like the general public, are all panicked about the stimulus money as being deficit creating and that the country is going to go into this huge debt and, you know, everything's going to fall apart. Whereas the stimulus money is money that's put into the economy to try to jumpstart the economy so that we can get out of the recession. You know, I think I heard yesterday, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Congress went into recess without extending unemployment benefits.
I think that's right.
A real problem. I mean, that stimulus, job creation, people spending money so that, you know, stores can sell and we can jumpstart our economy, that didn't happen. Whereas money going to the financial sector happened overnight without a blink.
Now, let me ask you this question. We've been talking about, of course, protecting certain economic and social rights through legal means, through getting us to sign the covenant on economic and social rights. But all of this and all of our discussion is still within the framework of what you would have to call one of the more rampant capitalist systems in the world, in the United States. And is your take on that we can really, by sort of reforming that system, actually get people the right to housing, the right to education, the right to a job?
That's a hard question. Are you saying is this a remedial patch up work on capitalism and the human rights will try and patch it up? I don't know.
Well, I'm saying obviously we want to fight for those reformist goals in a certain way.
Yeah.
But you're dealing with, you know, we were just talking, you can't get, you know, the idea of the federal government doing almost anything. We couldn't even get a junky little public option out of the health care bill.
I know.
And, you know, we're now talking about the FCC and net neutrality and getting the FCC to even be able to do anything with that. So we're dealing in a context that's utterly laissez-faire capitalist society. And, yeah, we can fight for some of these and we can get them in and then they'll say these rights are aspirational and they can't be enforced. And so it's reformist, and sometimes reformist things can lead to
other things.
Can lead to political, you know, revolutionary things and deeper radical issues. But I just want to get your take on that because I know you're not just a reformist. So
no. I think that there's two places. I think one is sort of the legal structures and people will, and you know that legal structures much more than I do. And I think it's important to sort of operate in those. For example, the United States is coming up for what's called a universal periodic review in the Human Rights Council in Geneva this next year. And a whole bunch of us who are part of the U.S. Human Rights Network are participating in that universal periodic review. We're trying to write a piece of that review on macroeconomic policy to say that part of your human rights obligations are macroeconomic policy, which is something that...
What is macroeconomic policy?
Macroeconomic policy in terms of the stimulus package, in terms of financial regulations, and human rights. And so I think one is to engage in that Human Rights Council process, but really, I mean, I think you would all agree, you know, change only comes from the ground up. And so I think it's trying to have in the mindset of people in the United States that they have rights and claim those rights. And when they do claim, I mean, it's already happening. I mean, I think the work of the U.S. Human Rights Network in terms of housing rights and people, you know, taking over foreclosed housing because they feel that they have the right to housing is a beginning. And I think what we need is for people to understand that as human beings and people living in dignity, that they have rights that they can claim. And if that mentality changes, then maybe the system changes from a different place.
Radhika, do you have a website that our listeners can go to?
Actually, if you just Google the Center for Women's Global Leadership, you'll see an entire section written on economic and social rights. Our Huffington Post there is articles there, but also a longer piece that we've written on the crisis and what we need to do about the crisis and the actions we want people to take. You should also look at the Perry website and the U.S. Human Rights Network website, which all gives tons of information on this new and growing human rights movement in the country.
What is the Center for Women's Global Leadership?
The Center for Women's Global Leadership is based at Rutgers University, and it's a center within the university that looks at several different issues on feminist takes on different issues. I just started as the new executive director in September. We're going to take a big part of our work on is economic and social rights. But we also look at violence against women. We look at UN agencies and how to work within UN agencies to look at women's issues. Our next project on violence against women is going to be focused on militarism and gender violence around the world.
Well, terrific, Radhika. And thank you very much for being with us and for being on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights and for being, I think you're our treasurer, right?
I'm the treasurer and on the board of the U.S. Human Rights Network.
There you go. You come from a very radical part of India, so tell us, I never get the name pronounced right.
Kerala?
Right.
I'm from Kerala.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.